Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome to Arts Roundup, an hour spent discovering the city's art dimension and talking to the exciting people making it all happen at a venue near you. In this edition, we take a look at life behind the Iron Curtain depicted in the Soviet Designs for Life exhibition currently running at Cambridge University Library. Artist Roberta Booth previews her new exhibition, New Morning, running at Murray Edwards College. As the Cambridge Film Festival gets into full swing, we talk to local filmmakers hitting the streets and a sample pick of the week with the festival's Kath Kemp. And a Cambridge market trader and family man sticks his financial neck out to create a new art space in Mill Road and appeals for funding and support to convert a large empty shop to bring together a stable of local artists. If you have an interest in art, architecture and design that underpins Soviet Russia, there's currently an exhibition you really shouldn't miss at Cambridge University Library. Soviet Designs for Life beckons you to don some 3D specs and take a peek over the Iron Curtain to discover an extraordinary collection of books, propaganda and journals and posters from the time of the Tsars right up through to Perestroika and up to 1991. The collection also contains architectural models, photographs and period paraphernalia and was assembled over several decades by Soviet architecture and design expert Dr. Catherine Cook, who died in 2004. Slavonic specialist and curator at Cambridge University Library, Mel Bach, gave me a unique tour through the Soviet century in this awe-inspiring and beautifully presented collection.
Why did you create this exhibition in the first place?
Well, the main reason behind it was to highlight Catherine Cook collection, from which all of the exhibits in this exhibition come. Catherine Cook left an amazing collection of books, journals, but also ephemera, posters, tickets, packaging, when she sadly died in 2004. And it's a wonderful special collection that we wanted to highlight and let everyone know about.
Can you tell me a little bit about Catherine Cook? Because she was an expert on Soviet architecture and design, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. Now, she did her undergraduate degree in architecture in Cambridge, but she only came to look at the Soviet Union later when she started her PhD, which was on Soviet town planning. And she's made many trips to the Soviet Union, and she started her collection actually when she was doing her PhD because she found that a lot of the specialist stuff she wanted wasn't available here because it was so specialised, and it was quite hard to go to the Soviet Union just to look at books, so she started buying things herself, and she ended up creating this amazing collection which is of very high academic value but also of really serious general interest because it's very, very visual. She didn't simply collect books and papers and so on, she also collected things that she found interesting examples of design.
Now this exhibition takes us through from the age of the Russian Revolution right up till 1991, a couple of years after the Berlin Wall came down. So it encompasses a vast amount of stuff, doesn't it?
It does. Now, I mean, Catherine's interest was predominantly in the first couple of decades of the Soviet Union. She was really interested in the kind of this very, very kind of febrile time when people were able to be so free in their design and they could really think beyond boundaries. So that is reflected in her collection, that it's predominantly earlier things, but she collected throughout the Soviet period and also before and after. And for example, some of the examples of packaging we've got come from the Brezhnev era much later on, because of course that's when she was making her own trips.
Okay, now the Russian avant-garde and constructivism are central themes. Why is that and what's that about?
Well, it is predominantly from Catherine's own interest. Constructivism was the area that she was most interested in, and it was this idea that that instead of design and art and so on simply serving a purpose, the purpose of being pretty to look at or whatever, that it really served the purpose of use, that it kind of responded to the political ideology. So when Catherine died, as we got as the final exhibit in the exhibition, is a book by Alexei Gann, who she was writing on when she died. And Gann was the most fundamental constructivist, and he really pushed people saying that, you know, if we're going to build buildings, for example, because she was predominantly interested in architecture, they have to suit not only the proletariat need today, but tomorrow and so on. And the only way we can know what's needed tomorrow is to understand the ideology.
What part did propaganda play in rearranging children's ideas?
For children, I mean, the first maiden case we've got here is about education, but of course it's not just about educating children in the way that, you know, we think of education for children, for young adults. It was also about educating the masses because, you know, when the Soviets came to power, you know, of course there'd been years of civil unrest and lots of problems, but also mass illiteracy and so on. But we've got a lovely example there of a children's book that is very, very politically educational, as well as being a lovely, beautiful, well-illustrated, enjoyable children's book. But it's about the Komsomol, this communist action, and about how to make sure building a factory and then getting wonderful results.
Obviously, the Soviets wanted to demonstrate their superiority and triumph over the bourgeoisie in agriculture, in industry, intellectually and artistically. And you have here in the selection the posters, the images that are supposed to support that. But when you look at them historically, they seem slightly unreal. But in the setting of this building, which is a 1940s imposing building, of much of that period, it actually is a very good setting for an exhibition like this, isn't it?
Well, it is one of those things that it's when we were looking, you know, we had designers to help us with the posters and stuff. And of course, we wanted it to be representative of the collection, the exhibition. So as I say, Catherine was interested in architecture first and foremost, but design more generally. And it's really nice seeing the posters outside, again, with the backdrop of this early 20th century building that is so monumental itself. The Soviet period is a very, very emotive issue. And lots of people, I think, come with you know, very clear preconceived ideas about, you know, their own opinions already set in stone about the Soviet Union. Some of the comments I've seen have shown that some people have turned up with an education that has been purely that the Soviet Union was bad. And their comments show that they had this exhibition shows areas that they hadn't really thought about, you know, physical beauty, but also I think some of the things about how, you know, it wasn't, even though many terrible things did happen, that actually it set out with terribly good intent. And I think we've also had comments from people who grew up in the Soviet Union who basically have kind of really enjoyed coming back and seeing ephemera from their childhood.
It is very exciting art in many ways, visually. It's, I mean, loads and loads of red, obviously.
Yes.
But it does have those qualities of sort of 1920s tourist posters in a way, kind of rebranded.
Yeah, it has been an amazing thing to do. I missed the, you know, it was very hard work to do, but I missed that work now. Because with the avant-garde, because at the time, you know, people were allowed to think really outside that, you know, you didn't just have to be a book designer or an architect, you could be all of these things together. But we have got a section in the section about work where we do have some examples of socialist realism, which was something that then kind of at the end of the kind of the more avant-garde period, it became actually the kind of the government-sponsored, government-approved form of art, which obviously completely turned things around so that you no longer had such freedom, you actually had a government ideal for art.
Mm-hmm. How important was it to create images, do you think, of heroes, statesmen and model citizens in this art?
Well, I think that, for example, with one of the socialist realist postcards you got is a poster, it's from a painting, which features the poet and artist Mayakovsky. And what's so interesting is that Mayakovsky, as a painter, was very avant-garde and not at all socialist realist. But in this very socialist realist setup, he's kind of shown painting, but in a way that he could, you know, he could be firing a gun, he could be building something. It's this kind of very, very heroic stance. And what's interesting is that within this socialist realist painting, his own work, of course, is shown in its kind of its own more simplistic avant-garde style. But I think having ideas of, like, kind of, you know, the upstanding citizen, and then of course later things of developing of not just kind of every man being some kind of hero, but having specific kind of almost idol worship of leaders, you know, having these strong examples is something, of course, people do think of immediately, you know, as a typical Soviet design. Probably my favourite exhibit here is the poster that's in the corner of the room, and it's a beautiful poster showing a march past a statue of Stalin. I think it's for the 1st of May, and it kind of shows progress with planes in the sky and so on. It's from 1925, and in the front you have four figures, which are two peasants, two urban workers, and it's all about this drive to make sure that after the Civil War had been won, that it wasn't just the urban proletariat who were with the revolution, that it got out to the peasants as well. And what's so interesting was that I mean, it's a beautiful, really breathtaking poster, and all it had was three initials at the bottom, and I was desperate to find out who had done it. And I went through endless lists of artists, and I had to give up. And then when I was writing the caption, I thought, I have to find out. So I tried again, and eventually I found a name that vaguely kind of correlated, and I ended up, by chance and the internet, getting in touch with the grandson of the guy who did it. And the artist had in fact been arrested and died in the gulag during the Second World War, and his son, the grandson's father, is still alive. And basically, he had kept what he could of his father's archive. And so when I asked the grandson if his father could check to see the authorship, I sent an image, and he then sent back this image, which is, we've got printed out next to the poster, which is from their own archive, which is for an earlier watercolour sketch. And what's so lovely is that, you know, you see the two together, you see how things changed, but also it was lovely because the family had never seen the finished poster. So it was a really, I was so pleased that people can know this person's name, and also that his family could see what, you know, that what had been done, and also know that in Cambridge people are looking at it.
Mel Bash, thank you very much indeed for a most interesting talk.
My pleasure. Thank you for coming.
Soul searching and reaching out for the sublime is something many of us do to try and feel whole as human beings. A new exhibition opens in Cambridge tomorrow by an artist whose art captures her inner journey in a series of striking canvases. Painter Roberta Booth describes herself as a journey woman in the inner realms, wandering through beautiful gardens and poetic spheres, guided by metaphysical research, contemplation and meditation. New Morning's Sacred Fusions exhibition encourages us to abandon our obsession with 21st century fashion and art trends focusing on the visceral and shocking, and instead explores the real beauty that sustains us and gives us soul sustenance in the real lives that we're leading daily. Roberta, a former art lecturer at Cambridge School of Art's latest batch of sacred art, was partly inspired by a recent trip to India and consolidates a painting career spanning some 40 years. Her work has been internationally acclaimed for its impressive breadth and versatility, ranging from anthropomorphic pieces in the 1970s through to myth and symbols in the 1980s and 90s to lyrical pieces more recently. Here she introduces the collection opening at Murray Edwards College tomorrow.
I think art's significance is huge in that it resonates with the whole psyche, evoking memory, feeling, dreams and half-forgotten ideas, childhood visions. It touches so much of us. It has enormous power, and it's a place where we can revel in our own imagination, which is man's greatest pleasure and solace.
This is now, what, your 40th exhibition coming up?
Probably round about that, yes, I think so.
Can you tell me a little bit about the progress of your work from back in the 1960s and 70s when you dealt largely in anthropomorphic pieces, the lyrical period in the 80s with magic colour, myth and symbol, and the 90s, and how did you arrive at this phase? And
what... I think most of my life has been caught up with me studying comparative religion, philosophy and psychology, so a lot of the work has been informed by my intellectual search, if you like. And really, even though superficially the work always appears to change, which I think it does for most artists, the underlying thing remains the same, and that is the mystery behind everything. So the thing that fascinates me is that notion of the mysterious, that we don't actually know what things are, we don't really understand things, and the more we extend our consciousness, the more we see. And I think an artist's life is often one of an extended or expanded consciousness.
Okay, now you deal in a very good knowledge of colour and metaphysics. What do you try to do with those to the person who looks at the art?
Well, I think what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to put together shapes and colours and imagery that will tweak the onlooker's memory, or give them a sense of something that they've remembered from the past. So in a way, the painting tells their own story to them. So it's not just my story. I'm putting references within the picture that will, and colours often, which will evoke a sense of memory for the onlooker. So the story is, it becomes their own.
Is it about finding a spiritual path and perhaps looking for portents in your mind to things that you associate with, to things that make you feel a certain way, that touch the spirit?
On one level, yes, I think I'm interested in the notion of the remembrance of awe that we might have. You know, like people look at landscapes, or when you see a sunset, you have that overwhelming sense of awe. Sometimes you wake up in the morning, you look out the window, and you're awed. I want to draw people back to that place inside themselves. Whether that's spiritual, whatever you want to call it, I don't mind what anybody chooses to call it, but it's to get away from the quotidian, if you like, to get to somewhere much deeper.
You seem to draw quite a lot on what looks to be stuff based in Oriental religious art. But why do you do that?
Well, I think that some of that is recent because I've been to India recently. But also my study has been through, as I say, comparative religion. So I've looked at all religions, and I've looked at the symbols in all religious art or in all spiritual art. So what I'm trying to evoke is a notion of the sacred. So I'm borrowing, if you like, sacred notions from all different spiritualities, all different religions. It's like trying to create something that's ecumenical. So it will touch and remind you of something very deep within you. But my whole life is meditating, painting, walking, and looking. So it's my whole life. How I would divide it up and say it's causes, that one has caused this or the other, I've no idea.
Do you believe in the divine at all?
I believe in the notion of the divine, yes. Yeah, how yeah. I would define the divine is something else.
And isn't that actually a very important part of what you do? Because you're saying that there is something divine, but you're not going to put it into a box. You're not going to say, well, it's this or it's that. You're just saying that it's there.
Yes, I'm saying that it's undeniably there, and that I actually believe it's undeniably there for everyone, because there's a presence of something that is so sublime that you can't ignore it.
Looking at your paintings, there are lots of images of beautiful and bright images of animals and things like that. But it's also about, as well as looking out of your mind, looking into it, isn't it? And finding things that are much more complicated in that relationship.
I mean, I think I'd see myself much more on that level as a shaman. There's a wonderful book called Dreaming with Eyes Open by Mike Tucker, who's a professor of poetics at Brighton University, and he talks about the inner journey of the artist, whether it's the musician or the painter or the writer, whatever, who takes the journey inward, looking at their own psyche, analysing their own psyche, looking at also all the different myths and symbols from other cultures and their own culture, and they come back and bring those things to the marketplace for other people to share. So we are the people that are taking the risks and taking the journeys, if you like, on an inward level.
Now, there seem to be two types of images that I can see here. Obviously, I'm not very familiar with your paintings, so I don't know that much about them. But you have the idea of ordered nature with beautiful gardens, with pools, porticos, and things like that, which is a sense of order. And then you have these very busy images with lots of things in them that say that they're very busy. They can be slightly confusing to look at for the first time. I mean, they have a big bright impact. What are you trying to say there with those two things? I mean, this kind of picture, which looks like an oriental garden with a portico.
I think those particular pictures were based on a notion of a story called The Conference of the Birds, which is a Sufi story. So I don't actually, I have never painted any animals other than birds. And this is a series called The Conference of the Birds. And in that story, the birds gather together to go to the city of God. So all the individual birds gather together and they tell stories about why they can't make the journey to the divine. And so there's a whole body of work that's about 3 years old that is to do with that. So that's one aspect of my work. But where you see complexity, I just see life, the universe, all of it as complex. And this particular body of work is about the notion of, you start with a set of principles, a world, a universe, and that set of principles, those ideas, break away, fragment, go off into space, reconjoin and create a new universe, and then fly off again and reconjoin and make another universe. And the whole idea behind this, which is called the Arc of Ascent, this painting, is that universes are created and recreated all the time, and artists create and recreate universes in the same way as the divine appears to. And that is the journey of the artist. But this particular piece of work was actually made up from, is a montage of 40 years worth of my paintings, all cut up and put back together in a different way.
Now your paintings are underpinned with tales, myths, legends, things like that. With this new exhibition, is there particular things that you've decided to found your ideas in? Is it constrained at all towards something specific?
Only in that I think it was a direct response to what I see as the desperately visceral, negative and dark 21st century art world rendition of what they believe art is. I see it as the antithesis of that. I think when I was younger, my paintings were much more political. Now I want to describe beauty back to people, because I think it's the beauty that sustains us and the sublime quality of nature that makes being here worthwhile.
Are there embedded clues and secrets within the paintings here? Because they do they do suggest things that you're supposed to pick up on.
Yeah, I think the thing is, if you know my work, and yeah. I have been painting for like 40 odd years, so I think if you know my work, you know what the clues are and you know what the symbols are about. But in a way, it doesn't really matter whether you do or not. Just the fact that you think, oh, that may have some significance, will make you question. So I think one of the things I'd say to people is sit in front of the work, just sit and have an experience with the work, and then you tell me what you feel, what you see, what you think.
Do you dream of a place like Elysium?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've got several paintings called Waters of Elysium, so yes, no, I think I do.
And that's a very ancient idea, doesn't it? Mm. Elysium goes back well before the Romans, doesn't it? As a place that the departed go to,
yes.
That is a land of bliss and peace.
But I think if you look at all religions, they all have that notion. And there's someone called Eliade, I don't know if you've heard of him, who writes about the notion of a paradisical consciousness, that we're born into a paradisical consciousness.
This exhibition is taking place at Murray Edwards College on Huntingdon Road. How many paintings will be included and what will people find there?
Well, it's a very small exhibition for me, but it's a summation of 2 years' work. So I think there are about 11 paintings. And I think what people will find is some, hopefully, pictures that are about joy and beauty and the sacred, and hopefully it will be an uplifting experience.
Celluloid is definitely flavour of the month, as Cambridge Film Festival attracts buffs from every age group to sample a wide range of films in the most unusual settings. The Film Festival's Kath Kemp previews this week's action, which will give you goose pimples and thrills on air screens in open spaces, some without costing you a bean.
Catherine, when was the last time you were in the sea and you swam out of your depth?
Probably earlier this year when I went to Galway for the Galway African Film Festival.
Do you believe all this stuff about sharks now being sweet and lovely creatures that we should nurture and care for?
No.
Do you normally find that when you're out of your depth in the sea, you're wondering what's underneath you?
Definitely.
Yeah. And that's what Peter Benchley really gave to the world, wasn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. And I think he gave sharks a bad name, really, didn't he?
But when you look at in the news, just in the last few weeks, we've had this sizable shark found off the coast of Wales 3 weeks ago, just 4 feet from the beach, in an inlet, which people were photographing. 2 days ago, a Scottish fisherman, Hamish Curry, was having a tug of war with a very large port beagle shark off the Hebrides and was actually bitten on the foot by it. And that was on the BBC website. The fear of jaws never goes away, does it? Because it's etched into every sea swimmer's memory, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like it's topical to be showing this film right now.
And this film is being shown at the Lido, Jesus Green.
Exactly.
What's the setup there going to be like?
So for anybody that's been to the Lido before, you'll know that it's a sort of 50-metre outdoor swimming pool on Jesus Green. And we have run events there the past few years where we've done clips. We've had a screen at each end of the pool, and we've had punts in the pool that you can sit on. So it's a very atmospheric evening. This year we're doing something quite different. We're showing Jaws for free. So you can come down and it's absolutely free. And we'll have two screens set up with the film. So you'll be able to sit on the shore of the Lido. and be scared.
Okay, this is obviously one of Steven Spielberg's the best films as director. Will there be any huge rubber sharks involved, as they do in Hollywood?
No, unfortunately, I don't think our budget stretches to that, but I'm sure people could bring their own if they want to enter into the spirit of it.
This has a very good star lineup. It has Roy Snyder as Police Chief Brody, Robert Shaw as the shark catching expert, and Richard Dreyfuss as a marine researcher. Why do you think this film worked so well?
I just think it's a combination of the music, the script, and just like you were saying earlier, being able to tap into everybody's almost irrational fear of what lies in the sea.
Well, it's an extremely good yarn, and I'm sure that everybody will enjoy that. When is it on?
So that's actually on this Sunday, the 9th of September, and the film will start about 8 o'clock when it's dark enough to show it.
The film festival's well underway now. Lots of other things coming up in the pipes. We've got the Varsity Film Roof at the Varsity Hotel is showing an archive programme. What's that all about?
So we've been working with Varsity now for a couple of months, and we've been screening films on their rooftop terrace. They have this beautiful rooftop terrace bar where you have these amazing views of the city. And at dusk, we set the screen up, and the film starts to play as the sun goes down. And we've mostly done feature films up until now, but on Sunday, the same day as the Lido, we're going to have an archive programme running there with some local archive material. We've worked with both the East Anglian Film Archive, particularly, have been really helpful. And so it's a really good opportunity for people just to come and dip their feet into archive film. I think not enough. Archive can be quite inaccessible for people, so we're trying to make it more accessible for people to watch local archive film, and it couldn't be a better spot to watch it when you've got this beautiful view of Cambridge below you.
There's workshops coming up as well, which you can find in the brochure for the film festival. There's also something interesting happening at Cambridge University Press, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. Our sort of summer of outdoor cinema is well underway, and we're actually doing two nights of screenings on Cambridge University Press's sports ground, which people might not be familiar with, but it's just off Shaftesbury Avenue, so it's very close to the centre of town. And they have this big sports field where we're going to set up two air screens. So anybody that came to Grantchester will know a little bit about the way we set that up. And we've got two films each night showing, a feature film and a children's film. And it's all, it kind of works like a silent disco, so you get given a radio headset, you can bring your own headphones, you can borrow some from us, and you tune into the right station, then you can sit and watch the film in this beautiful outdoor setting.
If you poke around in Cambridge with your brochure for the film festival, you'll be able to find all kinds of interesting things going on. There's also a screening of Alicia, Queen of Mars at the University Library.
Yeah, exactly. This year we've tried to go all out with our outdoor venues, so the University Library steps seemed like the perfect place to screen a scary Soviet film. So Alicia, Queen of Mars is screening there.
And in your view, a major organiser for the film festival, what's the pick of the week?
Well, two things. Jaws, obviously, is going to be fantastic. Yeah. But Saturday evening, we're actually doing a free screening of Mamma Mia at Saffron Walden Common for anybody that wants to come and spend their Saturday night dancing to ABBA.
Kath Kemp, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Cambridge's amateur filmmakers are inspired and active around every corner and do some quite incredible things. The Arts Picture House's Carl Peck, who moonlights with his friends making films with the Trident Project and secretly holds out-of-hour screenings at the cinema.
Project Trident we are a group of filmmakers. We met working here at the cinema about 5 years ago. We started making films together and putting them on in the screen after work. Probably without permission, but yeah, it's kind of progressed from there. And
could you tell me a little bit about the ins and outs of the kind of people who are making films on Cambridge's streets? I mean, obviously, just recently we've had mainstream actors shooting an episode of Restless with Michael Gambon and Hayley Atwell and various other people on the street. But there are lots of amateur film groups who operate from places like this and from Hills Road Sixth Form College, from Anglia Ruskin, things like that. What kind of things do you guys get up to?
Things we get up to. Well, I guess there's no limitations when you're making films with no money and not for any particular, funding or anything. You have free rein, so you're not limited by the constraints that perhaps, people in the industry are.
Do they necessarily have to be very short?
No, we've last year we premiered our film The Purple Fiend, which was just under half an hour long, and we're currently planning on our first feature film. It's in development at the moment. You kind of you learn as you go on who is good at what among you. You know, one of the guys on with us, Simon, he's really good at sound, and then another girl called Alex is really good at cinematography, and another guy, Tommy. You know, everyone's got like a thing they're good at, and so as you go on, that kind of shows through, you know.
And what about attracting funding? I mean, I noticed that there are groups like, there's a group who do horror films called Bloody Cuts. I don't know whether you're familiar with them.
Yeah.
And those are very short films, which they make and then publish on a website, mm-hmm. And then effectively appeal for funding, so that if people see those as showcases of what they can do, they can actually possibly attract funding for making something rather more ambitious as a project.
As we also have a website, projecttrident.com, where we put all of our shorts that we've made, and you can watch them there for free. But yeah, our plan eventually is to generate money, you know, somehow, so we can fund further bigger projects. You know, that's always the sort of goal that we're trying to approach.
Great stuff. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
There's scores of other groups doing talented stuff with films. I caught up with Cambridge Super 8 Film Club, who've just finished an Olympics-inspired project that has been like a honeypot for local kids. Here's Tony Clark and Chairman Thierry Bono. What have you been doing recently? Because you've been busy, haven't you, with an Olympics project to do film related to the Olympics recently.
Yes. We were given an opportunity to participate in the Cultural Olympiad, which was a very interesting thing. I forget entirely where it came from, though we were eventually funded by the County Council. We have a rather peculiarly niche interest in that we still make films using film cameras, all those little film cameras everybody's got in the attic, and they run on batteries and they clatter away. And there's a surprisingly interesting cult that goes around those of people who make films where you, because it's a film camera, you've got no chance to check your footage. You shoot entirely blind, you send it to a developing laboratory, what comes back is what you did. So you have to work entirely on faith. And there's grown around that a challenge that's got various names. In Britain it's called Straight Eight, where you basically shoot a film in sequence. You don't get to edit it, you don't get to see your footage, and what comes back from the laboratory, unedited, is your film shot the way you did it. And it's a sort of a roughy-tufty challenge. And we did a local variant of that, saying, do us a one-roll film with a supplied cartridge, choice of black and white or colour, something to do with, on the theme of Olympics, sport, competition, that sort of challenge.
What did that throw up, and what were the problems that you encountered in doing that?
Well, one of the problems we encountered was actually finding enough working cameras, and the fact that they were all different sorts of cameras, so some of them had different attributes, and we had to test them all. So that was fun, because we are talking about technology that hasn't been manufactured since about 1980, which is a challenge in itself. And the other interesting challenge, which we really thrived on in a way, is that we thought experienced filmmakers were saying, oh, I remember doing that, I can have a go. What we largely got was children, which was an interesting challenge, because obviously children nowadays barely remember film. This idea that you can't look at your picture is, you know, very odd to them. But we got a chance, one of the art teachers from the Cambridge International School contacted us and said, my class would like to have a go at this, would you lend us some cameras? And we said yes. And I think there were five or six groups who got involved in this. So we offered them that chance. They all got a camera each and a roll of film. They had a choice of colour or black and white. Interestingly, virtually all of them chose black and white, which again is a very interesting retro thing for them to have chosen. And we said, OK, here's how you do a storyboard. Here's how you sort of work up ideas. Here's how you time it. You've got 3 minutes and 15 seconds, not a second more. Go ahead and do it. Go back and surprise yourself. And they did the films. They all got very excited. We showed the films at the big weekend, and some of them had really got into this. Obviously, they were sort of literate from seeing stuff on YouTube and whatever, but they had no idea whether any of the sequences worked, and some of them did quite elaborate sequences involving dancing and athletics and holding up numbers in sequence. And they were really astonished. They said, I never knew it would look like that. And they got really amazingly into it. And at least two of the groups actually won the prizes, which were enormously high-value prizes. They were Olympic medals made out of plastic film canisters with a GB ribbon round it. A rare sort of you'll never see another one because my mate made them, sort of. So it was a very homegrown challenge, but it was very interesting. They said, oh, that's so exciting. We're going to do more of these.
Terry, do you want to say something about Super 8? What's your role in Super 8?
Yeah, actually, I'm one of the founders of a group, and I'm having the role of a chairman of a Super 8 group at the moment. And I've been involved with filmmaking, and I would say particularly Super 8 in Cambridge. So obviously with various members of the group, we made films over the years, and we are pushing to make, I would say, more collaborative or initiate production of new films. And one of the things we did was the Olympiad this year.
Yeah. So we have an awful lot of films involving Thierry's daughter.
All right.
there'll be an entire filmography when she grows up from the age of about two.
And how old is she now?
She's a natural.
She's going to be six. So she started in one of the films we did when she was two. So we did that. It was a fictional film.
Mm, child exploitation. yes. Mm. Yeah. So yeah, we have those. We don't tend to do particularly sort of grand productions. Mm-hmm. You know, we are limited by largely getting access to somewhere to shoot things and having friends to do stuff. So we've not really worked up grand concepts. They are little sort of 3-minute miracles.
When was the last time you really stuck your neck out financially to support something you really believed in? A Cambridge market trader and father of three has just ploughed the last of his inheritance on an outside chance of creating a 3,000-foot art space in a large empty shop that used to be Misfits in Mill Road to provide a centre for some 35 local artists, schoolchildren and a cafe for creatives. Some people think 51-year-old Frank Rousel is a bit crazy to take such a risk in the current economy, but the idea potentially has legs if he can muster enough support with a new campaign to attract funding and get it up and running quickly. ShowMeYourArt.com website gives details of the campaign to anyone interested. He joined Cambridge 105 to pitch to the city and pull together the arts community to create an important new resource.
Now the biggest obstacle, obviously, to setting up another really great art space in Cambridge, obviously Mill Road is an area that really needs it, it's full of artists, is of course the money. Now, I'm told that you have actually put up considerable sum of your own in order to try and make it happen.
Well, I've spent the last of my inheritance basically on trying to build a website and trying to get things organised. Although the website's not actually running yet, it's very shortly due to be up and running. Yes, but so it's going to be a free website for people, so that everybody can put their art up there for free, basically, and try to promote their stuff from there, basically.
No, that sounds like quite a commitment. Are you sticking your neck out financially as a man?
Well, I have done, yes. So I've stuck my neck out financially for this one, and now I've run out of money for it, and so we're looking for fundraising. Money, donations, sponsors.
What kind of sum are we looking at?
I think probably we need to see around about £30,000 to get the whole thing up and running properly. You know, I need to acquire art stands and stuff like this. And
have you approached local businesses, the city council, or fundraising organisations so that you can give funds to arts projects?
I've approached a few people, not with much success at the moment. Maybe I need to look in a different kind of way about doing that. But hopefully, this is what this is all about: is somebody will come forward and offer something. You know.
Now, there are other art spaces that have done similar things. Obviously, Cambridge Art Salon in Cromwell Road is a community of artists. It's been turned into a successful gallery, but they do not have the advantage of being on Mill Road,
which
is extremely important for footfall, for getting the public to come in and look at art.
Absolutely.
Would that be a basis for a strong argument for getting the City Council to support you?
Well, I think so, yes. I mean, it's at the right end of Mill Road, I think, you know. It could bring the whole of Mill Road together quite nicely, I think. You know, it's a community venture. There's lots of private housing down that end. Probably lots of wall space for people who need some art.
Now, what is the core concept of Show Me Your Art as a scheme?
Well, it started out initially. Initially, I wanted to start Show Me Your Art up as a free website, but as a three-dimensional website, which is something in the future. To do, but basically a free platform for struggling artists. really, to try and...
Of which there are very many in Cambridge
yes,
at the moment.
Yes, many, yeah.
What about, I mean, you're talking initially about some 35 artists or so who would be regular members of that.
That's what I would need per week to kind of fill the space and get the rent money back, really. Paying roughly about £30 a week. I mean, this figure's not set in stone, but it's approximate, and it could be less.
Now, I heard in the wind that you also wanted to involve local schools and children who are interested in art. How might that work?
Well, on the website, everybody will have a chance to set up their own profile, and I was kind of hoping to get the site set up so that all the schools could involve themselves in it, and maybe we could set up competitions between the schools and then work in conjunction with the shop up Mill Road when we get it, if we get it.
Now tell me a bit about the interior of the shop, because it's particularly suited for this purpose, isn't it?
It's great. Yeah it's fantastic. Yeah. It sits about 50 foot long with a bit at the end of it, which is about 30 by 10 for the shop selling art materials, and for a little cafe at the back. There's a huge basement in there as well, which could be used for photographic dark rooms, and people have showed an interest in that. I've had many teachers come forward who want to do courses and workshops in there as well. I've had quite a few artists come forward, but not enough at the moment.
What's been the response so far? Because you've actually got a band of people supporting you already, but you need much more, don't you?
Well, I've had a few groups of artists coming forward as well. The Cambridge Women's Photographic Group came forward, and they were talking about being interested in maybe taking on 2-3 spaces for their students. They have a group of about 20 students. I've had people come forward from the Buddha Centre. They do lots of art down there. Other groups coming forwards wanting to take a few spaces. If I can acquire more groups, a great thing, you know, because we can get, and also I want to work closely, like I say, with the schools and colleges, and like Anglia Ruskin, all the MA students, the BA students coming out. There's some great art coming out of there at the moment, you know, and it's really all about trying to keep the art in Cambridge, really, you know, and stop people from disappearing off to London down Brick Lane. You know, I love to see Cambridge become like a big Brick Lane, you know, full of artists, full of art galleries and places, really.
It's time to look at what's coming up in and around the city in the very near future. A new still life exhibition by artist Reg Cartwright has opened at Cambridge Contemporary Art, exploring complex spatial relationships between familiar objects in the British modernist tradition. The renowned Academy of Ancient Music offers a musical feast on the 19th at West Road Concert Hall, and then returns later to play Handel's Royal Music at the Corn Exchange on September the 27th. Highlights include Handel's Messiah and Water Music. Kettle's Yard unveils its third Artists in Focus display, looking at Winifred Nicholson and her relationship with gallery founder Jim Eade, running from September the 28th. At the Arts Theatre from Monday, Peter Bowles and James Roach celebrate Charles Dickens' 200th birthday with Dickens's play The Haunting, a tale of dark secrets in a crumbling mansion. Author of bestseller Birdsong, Sebastian Falk, speaks at West Road Concert Hall on September the 25th and launches his new book, A Possible Life, about a World War II prisoner's ordeal. And that's all we have time for in this edition of Arts Roundup. I'm Simon Burton, and thank you for listening on Cambridge 105 FM.